Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Productivity Mastery. I'm super, super humbled and excited to welcome my guest today. It's a special day. We were just laughing in the backstage. It's episode 150, and I would like to say special thanks to coronavirus for the opportunity to start this journey, start this podcast. And actually, we didn't plan it. We were just, you know, booking guests for the podcast, but I'm very, very happy that we have such a special guest joining us today. Somebody that I had such a pleasure researching in the last couple of weeks preparing for this podcast. My guest today, his name is Chris Williams. He's a guy who's a veteran in the field of leadership and technology, former vice president of Microsoft. Just to give you an idea, he was responsible for 32,000 employees, a $2.2 billion a year payroll, over $300 million a year in benefits, and led 1,000+ HR employees worldwide, working directly with Bill Gates, Steve Ballmer. Maybe you guys heard about these guys, and the board of directors. He has over 45 years of leadership experience. He's known as CL Will, and he's just a really cool dude. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I feel honored to be your 150th show.
We're so happy to have you. And Chris, I was reading your bio and where you come from. And can you maybe give us a bit of an overview about your story? Because from what I see, you used to be a tech guy, a product guy, and you ended up in HR becoming vice president of Microsoft. How did that happen?
Well, I was a coder. I wrote a lot of code. In fact, I've written code that I would almost promise everybody in the audience has run at one point or another. The code that you use when you install a program on Windows, the last time I looked, my code was still in that piece of code that installs Windows programs. And I wrote that code in, I'm embarrassed to say, I think it was 1990. And that code is still in there. I've had an absolutely wonderful, fascinating, diverse career. And that's one of the things that I advocate for anybody in business ever is to head towards the diversity of your career and doing weird things. My journey began, my first full-time job ended up being mostly about firing people. When I was like 18 years old, I was firing people for a living. It taught me a lot about what a good manager is and what a bad manager is, because my manager was so bad, he made me fire people. But I then got into the computer science. I got a degree in computer science before they even called it computer science. I worked in a market research firm. I was doing consulting work. I helped GM install the first robots in their factories. I did work with Johns Manville on why the space shuttle tiles were having a quality control issue. I eventually worked, that consulting firm I sold to a little tiny software company called Fox Software, and myself and five other people wrote a program called Fox Pro, which was the first high performance PC database system back in the late 80s, early 90s, that was bought by Microsoft. And when I got to Microsoft, this love of sort of doing all kinds of things, I was a kid in a candy store. I got to this company that was growing rapidly with all kinds of different opportunities in all kinds of different places around the company. And I used it. I explored it. I worked on the development languages, the software development tools for a while. I was the director of software development best practices across the entire company. I was the guy who started a small project. It was myself and my assistant. And within a year, we had 500 people and had released Visual Studio, which is the largest software development tool that still to this day. We sold $100 million in the first year of that product. And so I came off that huge success. I had been working all across the company. I had all these different experiences, and I came off that success. And like many good people, I thought, you know, quit while you're ahead, right? And I was thinking about maybe I should leave the company or do something like that. And my HR person came to me and said, you should be in HR. And I said, you should be committed. You know, what kind of a fool would go from a, you know, leading large scale tech teams to HR? And then I realized it had an incredible perspective across the company. It was a way to see all kinds of different places around the company. And it also highlighted something that I recommend to people even to this day, which is the ability to understand multiple languages. And I don't mean, you know, Spanish and Mandarin, I mean the languages of business. And so one of the things I had learned early on, I understood the tech. I understood how to write code. I learned eventually what a P&L was and how a balance sheet works and how, you know, to get into budget fights with my manager's manager and those kinds of things. And I really enjoyed learning different languages, and moving from tech into HR allowed me to be a translator. The people in HR were talking about compa ratios and employee engagement, and the managers in the line businesses were going, you know, what are you talking about? And I was able to go to the managers in the line business and say, no, what they really mean is, do you have a vision for your project? And this is what you're trying to do, right? And I often, the HR people would come to me and say, I don't understand the tech we're working on. And I had an opportunity to say, okay, this is what they're trying to accomplish. And so it was a great opportunity to be a translator. It was an incredible opportunity, as I said, to see across the entire company. And I mean, not to be sort of that guy who name drops, but it was also an opportunity to have regular one-on-ones with Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, right? So I had interactions with some of the smartest and brightest people on the planet. It was absolutely a blast. I had this enormous portfolio across the world. It was amazing. And there I did another thing that was fun. I changed the salary, stock options, job level, and benefits for every single employee on one day in early 2000. We changed everybody's stock, everybody's salary, everybody's job level in one day. And it took me a year of traveling around the world to get this whole thing together and make it all work. We rolled it out to all 32,000 plus employees, and I got one email. It worked so beautifully. The whole thing went perfectly. I only got one email of complaint, and that person didn't understand what they were reading. So it was an opportunity for me to leave on a high. And so I did that. It was absolutely amazing. And I left the company. And since that time, I've been consulting with startups. I was on the board of a nonprofit for almost 20 years. I do executive consulting and coaching now, which is the love of my life. I love working with smart people. And that's what I've been. So that's what I do now. That in, I think, 5 minutes is too long, but there you go.
Well, thank you for giving us the context. I grew up in Eastern Europe, in Bulgaria. I was born in 1987, and I remember in the 90s, you know, the first years of democracy, the TVs are showing America, whatever. And Bill Gates was the big shot, right? He was like the guy, right? Yeah. They always show him on the TV. And I wonder, what was it like for you the first time that you had to meet him? Were you intimidated? And maybe what were the first impressions you saw behind closed doors about his leadership?
Well, early on, when I first met Bill, which was in the summer of 92, Bill was, the company had just really, really started growing. It was doubling in size every year. And so in many ways, the company sort of outstripped his leadership capabilities. But Bill is incredibly smart, right? So, and he has this same sort of variety of perspective, a desire to learn all kinds of different things. So he would get deep down into the tech weeds, or he would try and understand the finance side of the business. He had a great guy, Frank Gaudet, who helped him run the finance side of the business and take the company public. He learned on all these different dimensions. His leadership style early on was, to be honest, what we used to refer to as sharp elbows. He would poke people a lot. He was often very aggressive, and he used a technique that, in fact, I think is not a bad one in its spirit, which was he would drill down on something to the point where someone would finally say, "I don't know." So, you know, you would say, "Well, I'm working on this. Well, tell me how that works." "Well, it works like, so how does that work? And what does this mean?" And he would drill and drill and drill and drill. And finally, he'd get to a point where you'd end up having a question that you didn't know the answer to. And it was kind of a test, and you didn't really realize it at the time, but the test was, were you able to stare at the richest man in the world and say, "I don't know," which is the honest answer, or would you just make stuff up? And there were all kinds of people who would just make stuff up. And that told Bill, okay, I don't know that I can trust the answers that you give me because you're willing to just make stuff up. And so that, but he would often do that early on. He did that in a very bitter way. He did, you know, he would, you know, poke at you and accuse you, you know, and call you stupid. His favorite phrase was, "That's the stupidest effing thing I've ever heard," although he didn't say effing. And so it was very aggressive. But as he got older, and as I, you know, he and I actually are only about 6 months apart in age. And as I was there and watched him work, he mellowed into a guy who really understood that leadership is an awful lot about the people, and that you need to figure out how to get along with people. He's a stunningly smart guy, not necessarily the best interpersonal. Lord knows there's all kinds of, you know, I'm certainly not going to get into whether or not his marriage is going well or not. But he is stunningly smart, just stunningly smart, and electrifyingly so. You know, the kind of sort of stop the whole room with, "Oh my God, I hadn't really even thought about it that way," kind of thing. So it's fun to be around, fun to be in the same room with.
You know, you can find a lot of stuff about him and, you know, online and everywhere. But what I'm curious to hear is more the one-on-ones. What was it like to have a one-on-one? Like, do you have to be prepared, have an agenda? Like, was it more sporadic? Like, how were your one-on-ones with him?
With the many times the one-on-ones we were having were usually about a specific person, one of the people in leadership. So the one-on-ones that we had were very often about a specific person. And so then they ended up being largely conversations. What are we going to do? This person, you know, I mean, I'll be frank with you. A lot of the time it was, this person wants a whole lot more money. Should we pay them that? How should we pay them that? What should we do about this, that, and the other thing? Or this person desperately wants to leave. How are we going to save them and keep them in the company? That kind of thing. So our conversations were, I would usually go in completely prepared. I mean, I would know everything about that employee. I would, you know, what their salary history had been, that kind of stuff. The conversations were very, very personal. And I think that goes to something I like to talk to people about in leadership all the time. You know, people tend to think of leadership as a team sport, right? They tend to think of it like you're playing, you know, football or something where you have a large scale plan for how everything's going to work. But it's very much a one-on-one thing, right? Any good leader is dealing one-on-one with the people they directly work with. And it really benefits you to know and understand the kinds of things, the ways in which that person works, the kinds of things that get them motivated, the kinds of things that upset them, the kinds of ways in which they like to learn, the kinds of pushback that you can give them that they will accept and the kinds of pushback that they will recoil at. And it's a one-on-one sport. And as I said, over time, Bill and others, every leader I know has learned that it's a one-on-one sport. And the way you get good at it is by understanding who the person on the other side is and the kinds of things that you can do as a leader to help them improve, to give them constructive feedback in a way that they will accept it, to nurture them and their career going forward. It's much more individualistic than people want to make it out to be.
And I wonder, once you got promoted as a VP of HR, did you have any specific ideas and strategies that you brought there in terms of attracting top talent? Obviously, at the time, Microsoft was probably a very powerful organization. But what was your, if you can share, of course, your strategy in terms of attracting the greatest of talent to the organization?
We had an embarrassment of riches at the time. We were getting 30,000 resumes a month. We had two shifts of people who did nothing but scan resumes into a database system because it was that, you know, we got them on paper, obviously, and there were two shifts of people who were scanning resumes into a system and then doing early rudimentary optical character recognition to translate it into the database. So we had sort of the pick of talent that we wanted. At the senior levels, though, it's again a one-on-one contact sport. I was deeply involved with the hiring of a person who was going to work for Steve Ballmer to be the president of Microsoft when Steve was CEO and take over much of the sort of day-to-day operations of the role. And we interviewed a bunch of people. I was deeply involved in signing the contract with the person that we chose. That person came in. They lasted less than 6 months because working for Steve is hard work. Those kinds of conversations, it's very, very much an individual conversation at that level. It's you have to search high and wide to see if you can find people who have the broad talent and skill that you're looking for. And it often also ends up being a chemistry thing. Do they know how to get along with Steve? Can they get into an argument with Steve in a way that doesn't end up being a fight, but is really just an argument about the issue at hand? All those kinds of things. So the higher you go in an organization, the harder it is to find people, if you're going to bring them in from outside, who can work effectively with all the peers they have to work with. Again, it's a one-on-one contact sport, right? And you need to find people who fit. It's hard work.
And what did you learn when it comes to leadership working closely with Steve as well, because probably they have very different leadership style with Bill?
Yeah. Steve didn't value people as much as he valued what the people could provide. And so Steve was very much he didn't really get the "I need to connect with these people" kind of thing very much. He valued deeply what they could do, their outcome, their results. And so it's a completely different approach. Steve was a really hard guy to work for. He demanded explicit loyalty. And at the time I was there, most of the senior executives were millionaires and didn't even need to be at work every day. And so if you got into an argument with them and treated them like crap, the occurrence of their badge ending up on the VP of HR's desk saying "I quit," that was not uncommon, right? Because they didn't need to be there. And so that was a lesson that I think was difficult for Steve to learn. And that was hard. It was one of the reasons why I left, is that Steve was a very difficult guy to be the head of HR for. I shared a wall with Steve Ballmer, my desk backed up to his, and it was not infrequent that he would come and sort of kick my door in and demand I would do something about something. And it was usually some person who wanted to quit. And, you know, it was difficult situation to manage. So anyway.
Oh, that's great to hear, man. Not great to hear in terms of, wow, good for you, but like great to hear in terms of like, thank you for sharing these stories and details. And I'm actually really happy that the world is leaning more and more towards caring leadership and putting people first, because I think organizations have been speaking about that for decades maybe, but only recently we can see that resources are being allocated for genuinely caring for people. And it's not everywhere, but I want you to maybe talk about that, how important it is for senior leaders to understand that we need to genuinely start putting people first.
Well, it's really interesting, because if you sit down with any senior leader, they intimately care about the people who work for them, right? They have regular daily contact with these people. Excuse me, they care about their career, they care about their experience, they know and understand what that person wants. They recognize this person's shortcomings. They recognize the kinds of things that this person could do well. So they get people-to-people management at a very narrow experience. What many of them have failed to do over the years is be able to relate that down the pipeline, right? To be able to understand that person's direct reports and their direct reports and their direct reports. And also for them to realize it's a lot like parenting or grandparenting, where you look a couple of levels down and you ask, you know, how, when I was your age, I used to. So they very frequently lose sight of what it took for them to get where they are, and the kinds of support and help and guidance and thought and whatever that they got along the way. Some of them made it despite not having that, but most of them made it because they had a manager who was a smart, thoughtful manager who wanted to help them get ahead, and then they got ahead and they worked. And so when you talk to them about their organizations, they get the one-on-one contact. What I try and do is get them to see how that is layered, and it's every single job in a company, whether you are a frontline manager, once you're a frontline manager, the job from there to the CEO is the same job. It's all just managing an organization of people. What changes is the scale of that job. So you go from managing a group of 10 to managing a group of 10 teams of 10 to managing a group of 10 teams of 10 teams of, 10 divisions of 10 teams of 10, right? It's just the scale that changes. The scale changes on time as well. You know, when you first start out as a frontline manager, you're worrying about today and this week and this month. And when you get to be a larger manager, you're worrying about this month and this year and maybe next year. And when you get to be a director, it's this year and next year and what. And when you get to be the CEO, you're suddenly worrying about this year and or this decade and how long this company can last and what's the long-term vision. And so all that happens as you move up that thing is a change in scale. The job isn't significantly different. And I try and teach senior leaders that kind of thing. You can have empathy for that second level manager because they're doing the same job as you. They're just doing it on a smaller scale. And you need to appreciate what they need and the kinds of support and help they need. The problem again is that managers, the human beings are only able to see a fairly small size and scope of something, right? So they look at their team, right? Their direct report. I don't care whether you're the CEO and your direct reports are the C-suite, or whether you're the frontline manager and your direct reports are the people on the factory floor. You that's the world that you occupy. And what I try and explain to the senior level managers is that's okay, but you need to recognize that each one of those people has one of those, and each one of those people has one of those. and show some empathy for the people all the way through the organization.
I had a great guest, another great guest on the podcast called Shane Herbert, who's a DOP from Hollywood, director of photography, shot some movies like Terminator, Salvation, yeah. Need for Speed, great guy. And when we talk about leadership, he gave me this metaphor. He said, Stoyan, my biggest challenge as a leader is to make sure that every person from my team is making the same movie.
Yes, yes, yes. There's no more important thing. That brings me around to one of my most seminal moments. It was the time I realized the importance of having a clear vision for what you're trying to accomplish. And what happened was I was, at the time, I was director of software development for the entire company. And I was, in that role, I was responsible for best practices. So we would find the best practices for doing, you know, coding, the best practices for software testing and whatever, and work to disseminate them through the team. And one day I came into my manager at the time, who was a guy named Mike Maples, who was in charge of all software development for Microsoft. And we were there for my one-on-one, and he said, you know, forget the one-on-one we had in mind. I just came from a project review meeting with Bill for a major project that we've been working on for months, and we just canceled the project because it was so off the rails. We canceled the project. And he looked at me and said, Chris, I need you to figure something out for me. I need you to figure out what separates projects that succeed from projects that fail. Because we'd had some of both, right? We'd had Windows and Office and SQL Server and Exchange and all these enormous projects that were wildly successful. But we'd also had Microsoft Bob and other projects you haven't even heard of that were canceled in the middle of their run. And this was one of those. This was a project that was run by one of the best managers we had in the company, and it had failed. The entire project was canceled and scrapped. And he said, you know, what happens? Why does this happen? So I did 6 months worth of work. I interviewed, I think it was 85 people total. I looked through project management logs. I looked through bug databases and all kinds of stuff. And I discovered an awful lot of things that were about like how to manage a software project, you know, use this kind of a tool to track your bugs. Don't do that when you're testing, that kind of stuff. But the consistent thing I found over and over and over again was that the projects that succeeded all had a clear, crisp vision for what they were trying to accomplish. They were going to be the fastest spreadsheet on the planet. They were going to be the best windowing interface. They were going to, right? They had a clear, crisp vision that was limited. It was also timed. You know, we were going to do this by this time at this point. So there was this very clear vision for what the project was about. And everybody in that organization had heard the vision, understood the vision, believed in the vision, was going to execute on that vision. The projects that failed, they failed for all kinds of different reasons. They failed because they didn't have enough money, enough headcount, the market changed while they were in the middle of doing it or whatever. But literally everyone that failed did not have a clear vision. And that the lesson to me was that having a clear vision lets you be resilient to the kinds of things that happen to every single project. So if you have a clear vision and you run short on money, you will figure out how to make the vision with whatever money you've got. If you have a clear vision and the market changes out from underneath you, you can decide whether or not you need to change the vision and move it over here or whatever. If you have no vision at all and the market changes out from underneath you, this group of people goes, well, maybe we should do this. And that group of people, maybe we should do that. And it's a mess. So not having that clear vision is the deciding factor between success and failure. It's one of my huge passions is that at every single level in an organization, and I don't care whether or not you're the accounts payable manager at a Fortune 500 or the CEO of some little small manufacturing company, whatever, at every single level, you need to have a vision for your organization. This is what we're trying to accomplish. Everybody needs to know and understand that vision. Everybody needs to be able to make decisions based on that vision. You know, if you're going to build the fastest spreadsheet on the planet and somebody wants to add these weird features over there, you can say, wait, that has nothing to do with being the fastest spreadsheet on the planet, right? So you can make decisions. You can hire better with a good vision because people are motivated and attracted to that vision. You can fire people because they're not following the vision. You can market the product better when you're done. You can... So a clear vision for whatever you're doing, and I don't care what it is, a clear vision is the thing that separates success from failure. I'm sorry, that's Chris, my rant. That's my, I'm deep.
Chris, I'm just getting fired up. I mean, it's like when you were speaking, I'm like, if I want to go and visit my friend Chris in Seattle, I know I'm going to Seattle to visit my friend. So if my flight got canceled, probably I'll take a bus to take it from another airport. But that's my destination. That's right. My vision. I want to go. I'm not going to go, oh, by the way, there's the Eiffel Tower in Paris. We can go there. Right. Yeah, but Chris is not there. I want to visit Chris in Seattle.
Right. And you also need to be able to say, I'm going to go visit Chris in Seattle next Thursday. Right. And so that changes a bunch of things. You can say, okay, I'm halfway to Chris. I'm most of the way to Chris. I'm all the way to Chris. Right. You can use, if you've got that clear vision that says next Thursday, I'm going to be in Seattle. You're right. You can take a boat. You can take a plane. You can take a whatever. You might not take a boat that's going to go through the Panama Canal because that's not going to get me there by Thursday. Right. So that clear vision helps you establish everything you need to know about what it takes to get there. It's absolutely true.
Very curious now to hear. I know, Chris, you're working with some of the most influential leaders out there, senior executives, startup founders, and so on. What is the situation? What is the percentage of leaders, senior leaders, that do have a clear vision and articulate this clear vision?
You just described the difference. Nearly every person I talk to has a vision in their head. They've got it figured out. They know what they're trying to do. They think they know what they're accomplishing. But one of the biggest problems is that they don't communicate it effectively and they don't use it effectively. So they know in their head, you know, I want to build this, you know, I want to build the greatest ice cream store in Paris. Right. I'm going to sell the largest volume of ice cream in Paris. Right. So that's my vision. That's what I want in my head. But if everybody in the organization doesn't agree or at least understand that that's what the vision is, then it's just your vision. You're just hallucinating. Right. You know, it has to be a shared vision that everybody understands. And one of the biggest problems I end up with leadership all the time is they say to me, look, we've had an all group meeting and I meet with my directs and I tell them what the vision is. And I say, yeah, so everybody in the company has heard the vision now once, right? And my point is you need to repeat that vision and repeat that vision and repeat that vision and say it over and over again, because the average human being needs to hear something three times to even hear it at all, let alone internalize it and make it important. So one of the things that most leaders say, oh God, I'm so sick of talking about the vision. I don't care. You need to talk about it 44 more times, right? You've got to talk about it all the time. When somebody comes into you with some decision, should we do X or should we do Y? Don't just say do X. Say we should do X because X aligns with the vision and Y does not. And so you use the vision and explain that the vision is what you're using to make those decisions, right? You need to be such an annoying human being that people look at you and go, God, it's Chris, the ice cream Paris dude. I am so sick of hearing about Paris and ice cream. But that's what you need to be, because people need to. What happens if you do that all the time and all the time, and every time somebody comes to you with a question and you say, this is what the vision tells us to do, pretty soon those people who are a layer below you or a layer below you will say, look, we don't need to go ask Chris what he thinks about this. He's going to answer because of the vision. So we should just make the decision based on the vision, because we don't need to ask him. We know what his answer is going to be. And so they internalize the vision. They start making decisions based on the vision. The people below them will go, shit, I don't need to go talking to my manager about what we should do, because because they're just going to make the decision based on the vision. So which one of these aligns more to the vision? We'll go that way, right? Again, the communication is the thing that almost every manager falls down on. And you can get at it. As I said, you can get at it by repetition. You can get at it by using decisions. You can get at it by one-on-ones when you're sitting with someone and saying, look, I'd love to promote you, but I don't see you out there promoting the vision enough. And so I'm worried about you, right? There's a million ways you can make sure that the vision is alive in your organization.
Back in the 60s, Chris, you probably know these stories, but Japan, still devastated from the Second World War, tried to get back on track and to make it as an innovation leader and being known as quality. And you know that they're very disciplined. So it's the story of the first bullet train in Japan. I think that the facts are that they won the Olympic Games in 1964. And there's this story with where the head of the railway stations brings all these top engineers from the country and says, we need to build the fastest train on earth. All right. They come with a project. Here is the project that's going to be the fastest on earth. In European terms, 100 kilometers per hour. I don't know how many miles per hour, but 100 kilometers per hour. The guy comes to them and says, okay, how can we make it 200 kilometers per hour? Imagine 100 is like the fastest. It will be the fastest. Nobody ever achieved it ever. The guy says 200 kilometers per hour. What do you need? Resources, people, advisory. Tell me what you need. We'll get you everything. The guys come back and initially they're resisting, right? They're like, oh, this guy's crazy. How do we do it? But then suddenly they start making small iterations, coming up with crazy ideas. And long story short, 4 years later, they almost achieved the goal. And they right. have this crazy fast. So they built tunnels under the mountain. They recreated the way whole thing worked. Now, I'm just sharing this story. And I just want to hear your opinion from practical terms. How ambitious should the vision be?
I have always believed that a vision should be what way back in the day, we used to call them BHAGs, BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal, right? It should be something that is, in many ways, it should be shocking, right? It shouldn't be ridiculous, right? If that person had come and said, I want to do 1,000 kilometers an hour, everybody would have thought you are absolute. I mean, you're just insane, right? That's just not going to happen. Let me tell you why the physics won't work there, right? But if he had come and said, you know, the same result might have happened if he had said 300, right? So it's tough to judge. But if he had come and said, well, the fastest train in the world is 100 and we want to do 102, you know, okay, fine, we can do that. We'll take their technology and tweak it a little. But by making it an audacious goal, by making it, you bond people tighter together because we got to figure out how we're going to do this, right? You set an objective that is going to be incredibly thrilling when you get there or when you get close, right? You're going to build a team like no other. I mean, I think it's important to note that they shortly, not long after that, they did get to 300, right? So, you know, the idea of setting a goal that is just outside of your reach, or is at least, you know, outside of your reach enough to inspire people, often changes everybody's perspective on things. And let's remember that whole thing started because of somebody with a vision for something, right? If they had just said, well, what we're going to do is iterate on what we currently have and get faster and faster and faster, no one would have made the leaps in technology necessary to make that change. You need somebody with a huge, strong vision pushing for whatever they're going to do. And we've seen it time and time again. Obviously, Steve Jobs with the phone that had no buttons on it. And people just thought he was absolutely out of his mind. And if you can find me a phone with a button on it these days, I'd love to see one. You know, okay, that's not fair. They do have a button on them, but, you know, but those kinds of setting a strong vision with this is what I think really needs to happen is incredibly motivating. But here again, remember that that it requires that. So, for example, Steve probably, I wasn't in the room, although I've met the man a couple of different times. Steve was probably sitting in a room when he said, I want a phone with an entirely glass screen on it, right? With nothing but, you know, that on it. And the people around the room probably said, geez, I'm not sure how we're going to do that. But let me, he would explain why he felt that was important. And then he knew that what to ask out of the hardware dude. He knew what to ask out of the software dude. He knew one-on-one what the various components needed to be and what the people on his team were, what he needed to ask from each one of those people, what was too much to ask the hardware guy and what was not, or how to ask the hardware guy who was this kind of a manager and he needed to be pushed or didn't need to be pushed, right? So he knew what his team was and what his team could do. Again, it circles back around to this. Leadership is a one-on-one sport, right? And you know, sitting in those rooms, he was dealing one-on-one with people in the software side and the support side and the connectivity. Remember, the biggest problem Steve had in the beginning was getting a phone company to sign on. So he had people out there marketing it to AT&T and Verizon and the, right? So, and he had to deal with each one of those things separately and individually.
This is such a powerful reminder that leadership is one-on-one. It should be individualized, right? Sometimes we are so much rushing that we kind of want to scale it, right? Like, let's treat everybody the same way properly, but let's treat them the same way because we don't have time to personalize and individualize. And what you're saying is, no. Every person acts differently, and you need to be, somebody told me once, you need to be like a chameleon as a leader. You change your color depending on who's in front of you.
At the very least, you need to be, I agree, and I used to think that you really needed to be a chameleon, but the problem with that is that that is putting a huge amount of burden on the manager to adapt to you. So what you need to do is find the middle ground. Like, for example, one of the things that drives me crazy is people who talk about servant leadership. Like, I am here to serve my team. Well, yeah, but that's an incredible burden on the manager to be, all I am is your servant. Tell me what you need. No, we are all servants to the vision. And if you and I are both working towards the vision, I need to know what kinds of things you need to be good at. I need to know what kind of feedback you need. So yes, I need to tune myself to you, but I don't work for you. And in many ways, you don't work for me. We all work for this vision that we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to accomplish this thing. If I can help you get along better with your peers so that we all appoint to this thing, we're better off, right? So I don't like putting the burden on the manager to be this sort of magical psychological counselor who is the supporting star to everybody. I just am asking you to recognize that people are different human beings, and some of them need different kinds of feedback. Some of them need different kinds of motivation. Some of them are having terrible problems in their personal life that you need to be at least cognizant of and supportive of and helpful. You know, geez, I'm sorry that's happened to you. Why don't you take a week off? Whatever it is, right? Everybody's an individual. Somebody walks in or you meet somebody on Monday and they're a completely different human being than they were last week. You got to say, hey, what's up? Is everything okay? You know, it's a one-on-one contact sport, but we're working together for something. I am not your servant and you are not mine.
I'm getting a deja vu because last week I had on a podcast, my guest, Mark Crowley. He had the exact same 3 minutes rant, like exactly. So thank you for bringing it as well.
A bunch of the sort of gospel that seems to make its way around the leadership coaching, leadership advising community, particularly on social media, particularly from young people who haven't ever really led a team before, is this whole idea of, there's all these kinds of obligations and expectations that you put on managers for servant leadership, for being incredible empaths, for being, you know, but they're just human beings. So that's why I find the focus on the vision, the focus on the project, the focus on what we're trying to do together, that builds teamwork. You and I are working together. We're trying to accomplish this thing. How can I help you do that? Yes, that, and how you're looking at me going, how can I help you do that? Right. It's what builds a team is not, you know, me ordering you around, and nor is it me bending at your feet saying, how can I help you? Right. It's how can we help each other to make this thing work? And the minute I find managers who pay attention to each individual human being and are cognizant of all, you know, those sort of few basic things, you know, how do they like to get feedback? How do they like to be motivated? What kinds of issues do they typically have with their peers? As soon as you understand some of those kinds of things and how, you know, what kinds of things work best for them, you automatically will be better at working with them. You just, and again, you don't need to even almost proactively do it. You just need to recognize it, because you're a human being and you will do the right thing. If you recognize that somebody doesn't like getting yelled at, you won't yell at them, right? Other people need to get yelled at to get motivated. So you learn to, you know, when I'm sitting down with Stoyan, I got to scream at him or he won't, you know, move. Okay, great. And Stoyan probably goes, yeah, I really need to kick in the tail in order to get anywhere, right? It's just how you work.
Oh, that's a good clarification, right? The vision, the results, the productivity, super important. That's why we're here for. I think probably what these movements did good is to bring the people factor more into the equation, because maybe it was a little bit too far out into the Steve Ballmer way, right? So we need to balance out, but it needs to be, hey, here's the vision. That's why we're here. And some people obviously not so good in people skills, and they need to learn to care and to genuinely care for their people. But that's more of a, that's not why we're here.
No? Right. Right. And to be clear, you just nailed it, right? So in some ways, the Steve Ballmer approach to leadership is the vision is the only thing that matters, right? Is the dollars, the bottom line, the vision, the whatever we're trying to accomplish, that's the only thing that matters. And what I'm suggesting is that somewhere in the middle is this ground where we together are the only way we're going to get there. So we have to figure out how we're going to work together to get to that vision. But again, one of the things that I tell younger people, and they laugh at me, is that there is imposter syndrome in the C-suite. There's imposter syndrome at every single level. They are just human beings. They question whether or not they're good enough to be doing what they're doing. Yeah, I can guarantee you that I had conversations with Bill Gates that were, I am overwhelmed with how am I going to deal with these people, right? Those conversations happen at every single level. Am I doing the right thing? Is this the right way, right? They are people too. And so expecting them to be magical gurus of fonts of wisdom all the time is unrealistic and unfair to them. They are doing a hard job. It's, again, it's the same job you're doing. It's just at a bigger scale. And recognizing that that job is the same all the way up humanizes that job. You know, I get so frustrated on social media when I will post something about some senior level and I get these comments that are like, all management is evil, right? Well, you know, all management has a family and goes home and whatever. They're trying their best too. And to be honest, they probably don't feel like they're doing a very good job, just like some days you don't either, right? It's everybody's just doing their best. And as soon as you try and understand what they're doing, you can understand it a little better. I've run into a few people who are truly, you know, I wonder whether or not there's something, you know, evil inside them, whether they're possessed by something. But it's been a handful in a career that's 45 years. The vast majority of them are people who are just doing their damnedest. They just happen to be doing it at the C-suite of a Fortune 500 company, right?
And since you mentioned young people today, you probably meet a lot of young leaders as well. There's a lot of listeners on the podcast. young leaders coming out of college or still at college, very ambitious, observing them and the environment they grow up with, what would be your advice for young leaders out there in terms of creating a successful career, but also not forgetting happiness?
Well, you know, this is another place where I think expectations get out of control for some people sometimes. One of the things that I see people say is, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life, which is, you know, like, I've never worked a job. I've loved what I do sometimes, but I've never worked a job where I've sang on the way to work, right? It just doesn't, you know? And the people who do that, God love them. Congratulations. You're an artist and you do nothing but what you want to do and make millions doing it. Congratulations. You're a really rare person. But for most people, a job is an interesting challenge. And what you can do is try and find the next interesting challenge. I tell people all the time, please do not plan your career. Please do not try and figure out that, okay, I'm going to do 2 years as a middle manager, and then I'm going to move to be a director. And then 3 years after that, I'm going to be the VP. And then I'll be the, don't do that stuff, right? It's a recipe for disappointment. You're going to move into something else and, or the project is going to fail and you're going to get derailed and you're going to say, oh, I'm off track for my vision of being the CEO. Stop that stuff. What you should be focused on is A, getting really good and knowing what you're doing now, and B, focusing on what the next thing is. What is the next thing that's interesting to you? What's the next thing that's a challenge? What's the next thing you want to do? And then what you should do is figure out what it takes to get there. And usually those things aren't particularly difficult. Particularly, like, for example, let's say you would like your boss's job, which is a very common thing for people to say. Then my suggestion is understand everything there is to know about what your boss does for a living, right? Understand the kinds of things that keep them awake at night. Understand the kinds of things that they struggle with doing. And just, again, you don't have to have the answers to all those questions. They don't have the answers to all those questions either. But you need to understand what the kinds of things they're dealing with. And if you can do your job, be really good at what you're doing, and understand that next level, to them, you look like somebody who gets it, who understands what it looks like to do that job. And you are much more of a promotable human being. So the other thing I did it in my career and it worked for me. So I recommend it to people, and but your listeners are adults and they can decide whether it works for them. But I did a wide variety of stuff. I was always attracted to doing something different. And one of the reasons, the first thing I recommend to nearly everybody who graduates from school is go work for a big company. And people laugh at me when I say that, but I think you should work for a big company because it gives you this world is your oyster, this kid in a candy store opportunity. You can work in this area for a while. You can decide that, you know, product marketing is kind of an interesting avenue. I never really thought about the challenges that happen on the factory floor. I wonder if I could go do an internship over there or learn to do something over there. Maybe, oh God, international sales has always been fascinating for me. So I want to go do some of that. And by doing that, you accomplish several good values, right? First of all, you learn a lot. You learn to speak different languages. You know, you learn what sales is about. You learn what finance is about. You learn what, right? So that's, you learn more. Two, you know people all throughout the organization, right? You know people all over the place. And the more important thing is they know you. So you've now gotten this experience. You've done two or three different jobs in different parts of the company or on different projects doing different things all the time. Senior leaders are sitting in a room going, we need somebody to lead this project, or we need somebody to do that thing over there. Anybody got any ideas on who should do that? And if your name is, they will go, oh, hey, Chris, he's a good guy. I've met him a couple of times. He could do this. And once you get above a certain level in a company, the promotions happen not because people are looking through resumes. It's because they've worked with you. They know who you are. They know you're smart and talented. And yeah, maybe you don't know how to do this specific job, but you've shown that you can do this job and that job and the other job. So we can think that Chris can do this job over here. So My recommendation to anybody who's young is to try and do as much as you can in as many different ways as you can and get to know as many people as you can. And that's easiest in a larger organization because there's just so many places to go and move without having to get new health insurance or new whatever or get a new job, right?
No, absolutely, man. Just reflecting on what you're saying, I've graduated as a master in finance, wanted to be a banker, but I got really passionate about movies and creating videos and short films, organizing film festivals. And I wanted to get into the movie industry, but I didn't have a degree. So I would go to movie sets and I'll talk to people, master degree, right? I'll talk to people and say, what can I help with?
Right.
Can I make the coffee? Can I do the salads? So I just wanted to be around the people that I want to be like one day. And at some point they were like, oh, this Toyan guy, he's really working hard. He's really organized. Oh, do you want to be a project coordinator? Oh, do you want to produce our next slowly?
And also what would happen is that they would say, oh, and you have finance experience. So maybe you understand how this works over there, right? So having a broad range of experiences and whether or not those experiences are from college or whatever, or whether they're from just you trying a bunch of different things, that is the heart of it's a key to great happiness. It's a key to learning a lot of different things, which for me, learning is the key to life. So learning a bunch of different things, understanding a bunch of different things. I mean, one of the things that keeps me awake and is people who are really good at what they do. And I'm sure you felt that way when you got on a movie set for the first time and you saw the first director and you thought, my God, that guy understands how this works. It's so much fun to watch them work. You just want to be in the room with those people. And I've been in the room with a great plumber and watched them work and gone, my God, it's amazing. How did you know how to do that, right? And so if you can take joy in learning and fascinating and associating yourself with good people, it's an amazing life experience that you, every time you come around a corner, there's something new and interesting to figure out and do. And once you've done that, you build this incredible library of skills that you have that are incredibly broad.
Thank you so much, Chris. And I just want to wrap up this with a different kind of question. You mentioned you met this exceptional plumber, but you also met some of the, in reality, some of the most popular, famous people on the planet. Can you maybe share, who are some of the people that you've met? And maybe like if you have some kind of an interesting story or like a funny story with somebody that the audience knows probably, because, it's going to be just an interesting way to finish.
So I was, for a while, responsible for Bill Gates has this thing called the CEO Summit, where he has a whole bunch of different CEOs from the top 100 CEOs around the world would come to this summit, and he'd have them at his house. And a couple of years in a row, I was responsible for a large chunk of that. And so I got to go to the events, and I was at this one event. It was a cocktail reception, and this one event, and this woman comes charging over to me absolutely and says, oh, you're Chris. Oh, I need to talk to you. Turns out it's Martha Stewart, and she has built this media company with all these employees, and she wanted to talk to me about employee retention, how to manage employees, when to fire somebody, how to do something. So Martha Stewart and I are standing in this reception having this long conversation about how to manage her team. It was absolutely fascinating. Those CEO summits, I sat next to Michael Eisner, who was the chairman of Disney at the time, and we were trash talking the people who were talking on stage. It was I had dinner sitting next to Jack Welch and Warren Buffett at the table, and it was absolutely fascinating to have. One of the things that most people don't know is that Jack Welch has an incredible stutter and can barely, at a reasonable conversation, he has a really difficult time. But when he's given a speech and whatever, he's great at it. But I was really fortunate. I just absolutely fortunate. So let me wrap up with this one little story. So at the end of this one evening, all these CEOs climb onto buses, right? And so these are, and they climb onto these two buses because they're going to go back from the hotel to Bill's house. But Bill shows up, and he's been very good friends with Jack Welch, who was the chair of GE, Warren Buffett, who I think all your listeners would know, and Bill. And the three of them come trottling down the stairs a little bit later, and Bill's car pulls up. And I'm standing there next to Bill's head of security. Bill had his own security person that he paid for himself because, you know. And Bill's car pulls up, and it's an armored Lexus. It just looks, it was almost purple, but it was armored, and you wouldn't know that if you looked at it. But anyway, and Bill Gates gets in the car, Warren Buffett and Jack Welch, the three of them get in the car, and they're going to follow the buses back to Bill's house. And I turned to his head of security, and I said, that's $200 billion in that car. And he goes, you don't think I know? And the next car that comes out is a jet black Suburban loaded with his security team and followed him off to the right behind him. So anyway.
Oh man, that's incredible. Thank you for sharing. What a great way to wrap up episode 150 with Chris Williams, ladies and gentlemen. You got to follow this guy. So much wisdom. I want to ask you 172 more questions. So I hope we're going to get a chance to have a second round.
I'd love to talk to you some more, Storian. This has been a great time.
Chris, final question. Where could people find you, follow you? I know you're producing content these days. And also, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there right now listening, you know, startup founders, senior executives that might be interested to get you on board. Where could they find you and how could you help organizations and top level leaders?
Well, I go by CL Will. Don't ask me how that came about. CLWILL. It actually comes from my mother many decades ago, but that's beside the point. So you can go to clwill.com. And you can find out all kinds of interesting stuff about what I'm doing, the consulting works I do, a lot of the various videos, and find links to my social media presences on, I primarily post on LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok, because that's where I get a lot of traction. I've got almost 250,000 followers on TikTok, which is something that I'm not really sure I completely understand, but that's great. And I love it. And they're absolutely wonderful people. And I have a marvelous time with them. But you can find me on LinkedIn. And generally, if you search CL Will, you'll find both my website and my YouTube channel and my social media presences. So thank you very much.
You know where to find Chris. CL Will, guys. Make sure to follow Chris. And if you guys enjoyed this episode 150, meaning there's 149 more episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. So make sure to subscribe, share this episode with a friend, and let's continue spreading greatest leadership advice from the people who've been there, done that, like Chris Williams. Thank you so much, Chris, for being with us, for sharing with no BS filter. And what a great way to have 150 Jubilee. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.